Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council, who looks at the increasing tension between the U.S. and Iran after the United Nations' imposition of economic sanctions on Tehran. Ken Bossong of the Sustainable Energy Network, who discusses the demands of more than 100 groups for a shift in federal research funds from fossil fuels and nuclear power to energy efficiency and the development of renewable resources. And Craig Aaron with the group Free Press, who talks about the upcoming National Conference for Media Reform, where thousands of activists will gather to advocate the democratization of the nation's media system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a matter of days, Somalia's fundamentalist Union of Islamic Courts, which took over Mogadishu by forcing out warlords in June, collapsed after facing troops of the internationally recognized interim government of Somalia Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi, with critical support from Ethiopia's army and air force. On December 19th, fighters loyal to the Union of Islamic Courts were poised to attack the interim government that was isolated in the small market town of Baidoa. On Christmas Day, Ethiopian jets bombed the Mogadishu airport and the Islamists went into full retreat. By New Year's, the leaders of the Islamic Courts had fled Mogadishu heading for the Kenyan border. The Islamists pledged to fight an insurgent war against the new government. According to Reuters, American-trained Ethiopian troops were expected to remain in Somalia for many months, waiting to be replaced by peacekeepers from the African Union or the United Nations. As Somali Prime Minister Gedi told reporters, the Ethiopians will leave only when they clear the terrorists and pacify Somalia. The new government in Somalia, the first since former dictator Mohamed Siad Barre was ousted in 1991, ordered the citizens of Mogadishu to disarm or the guns would be taken from them by force. Looting by people in Mogadishu after the fall of the Islamic regime also raised fears of a return to warlordism. Ethiopia's armed intervention of neighboring Somalia to eliminate the perceived Islamic threat has divided Africa. It also surprised many Western journalists who had given credit to the Islamic courts for bringing stability to the lawless nation. The UN-recognized transitional government of Somalia includes some of the warlords that the Islamists drove out in June. In mid-December, President George Bush relaunched his $1.2 billion malaria initiative. The program, run in tandem with the administration's $15 billion African AIDS program, aims to reduce malaria deaths by half in 15 hard-hit African nations. Malaria kills over a million people each year. Children under 5 are most at risk from the disease. The malaria plan has embraced ACT or artemisinin-based combination therapy, using a new anti-malarial drug with older prevention techniques like mosquito nets. Trials of the new therapy in Kenya and Ghana have seen a reduction of malaria deaths by up to 25%. Yet the U.S. Agency for International Development, or AID, has downplayed artemisinin, according to the Washington Monthly. The bulk of AID malaria funding goes to U.S.-based consultants and marketing schemes, not for the development of new drugs. Due to neglect by AID, hard-hit nations like Mozambique cannot afford artemisinin, which costs $2.50 per treatment, more than 20 times the cost of the now ineffective drug chloroquine. In a biting critique of AID's malaria campaign, the conservative American Enterprise Institute contends the funds either never left the United States or funded the employment of U.S. citizens. British Petroleum's environmental credibility took a big hit in March 2006 when a corroded transit pipe ruptured in an oil field in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, spilling 200,000 gallons of crude oil. It was the largest oil spill on Alaska's fragile North Slope. Corrosion in another BP pipeline in Alaska prompted a congressional investigation into whether BP had neglected basic pipeline maintenance. For a decade, BP, under the leadership of John Brown, had pledged to go beyond petroleum by taking action against global warming and painting all of the oil giant's gas stations green. But in 2004, less than 1% of BP's corporate revenues came from solar energy. Moreover, the oil company faces a possible investigation for violating the Federal Clean Water Act. According to an article written by Bill McKibben in Mother Jones magazine, BP's environmental problems expose the real limits of corporate social responsibility. BP was seen as a good guy, but never strayed far from the bottom line. Small companies like Ben & Jerry's and Seventh Generation can prosper by appealing to liberal social values, but they never challenge the basic tenets of global capitalism. In Europe, regulators have mandated car makers reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 25% or face sanctions. This big stick approach to restrain destructive corporate behavior is nothing new. It goes back to Teddy Roosevelt and the trustbusters of the early 20th century. But since the Reagan era, corporate political power has grown exponentially with little opposition. Now, McKibben asserts, is the time to once again set limits for corporations through the machinery of our political system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
After months of tense negotiations, the United Nations Security Council voted unanimously on December 23rd to impose limited economic sanctions against Iran for that nation's refusal to halt its uranium enrichment operation. The Council voted to block all countries from selling technology and equipment that could assist Iran in developing its nuclear research and missile capabilities. In addition, the UN froze the assets of 10 Iranian corporations and 12 individuals linked to its nuclear and missile programs. Iranian officials responded defiantly, vowing to continue their enrichment of uranium and warning of future changes in their relationship with the UN Nuclear Monitoring Agency. With the Bush administration's decision to dispatch a second aircraft carrier group to the waters off the Iranian coast and the recent arrest by U.S. soldiers of four Iranian diplomats inside Iraq, tension between the U.S. and Iran appeared to be on the rise as the new year began. At the same time that Mr. Bush rejected the Iraq Study Group's recommendation for opening talks with Iran over the situation in Iraq, the rushed execution of Saddam Hussein threatened to escalate violence between the majority Shiite and minority Sunni population. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, who looks at the increasing tension between the U.S. and Iran in the context of the continuing American occupation of Iraq.
I think the sanctions resolution that was passed by the Security Council is not going to be that important in terms of the actual pain it can impose on Iran. Rather, the importance of the sanctions are twofold. On the one hand, the international community has, through the Security Council, basically blessed the idea of sanctioning Iran under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. That's important for the United States that wants to take much firmer action against Iran. That, in turn, has given an air of legitimacy to the real sanctions that the United States is imposing currently on Iran, through its financial sector. The U.S. is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Iran and on foreign banks not to deal with Iran. And those sanctions, I think, are going to have far more of a financial cost to Iran than the sanctions passed by the Security Council. The critical conclusion, however, the Security Council sanctions are not going to resolve the situation with Iran. The only thing it's going to do is to increase the cost on the Iranians and increase the cost on the international community. It's no longer about finding a solution or a compromise. It's about seeing who can endure the most pain.
Trita, I wanted to ask your reaction to reports that the U.S. military has arrested several Iranians inside Iraq, including Iranian diplomats. There is some speculation that the Iranians who were arrested were somehow involved in arms smuggling or in other ways involved in attacks on the United States and Iraqi police or military.
I don't know about any credible information that would support what you just said. What I have heard, though, is that the Iraqi government at the highest level, the president, Talabani, as well as Hakim, who recently met with President Bush, had invited these diplomats to Iraq for various discussions, and that they are absolutely infuriated that the United States has arrested them. The fact that they're Iranian diplomats in Iraq should not be a surprise to anyone. Iran is the first country that actually recognized the new Iraqi government besides the United States. the fact that there's tons of Iranians in Iraq is not only not a surprise, it's also a very normal thing to happen between two countries that do have a lot of cultural ties.
What do you see when you look at the action of the U.S. Military sending aircraft carriers to the Persian Gulf as a sign of force, with Iran being the target, obviously, and then you have this arrest of Iranians inside the nation of Iraq? There has been some talk in the past that the United States may ultimately go for a military strike against Iran's nuclear research facilities. Do you think, with all the horrible morass that we're seeing now in Iraq, do you think the United States would take such a step?
I think what is happening is that the recommendation to talk to Iran has been rejected. The president is looking at the situation. He knows that it's extremely grave. I think finally he's starting to realize that. And the way out that has been painted for him by the Baker-Hamilton report is simply contradicting his ideological views, which is, for instance, not to talk to Iran. So the next option is challenge Iran. And there's many countries in the region that would actually support that. The Saudis right now are quite fearful of a U.S.-Iran dialogue, thinking that that might come at the expense of Saudi interests. So they want to see the United States challenge Iran in Iraq by supporting the Sunni insurgency and the Sunnis in Iraq in order to fight the Shiites that tend to have close relations with Iran. If that were to happen, then we're basically seeing the United States taking sides in a civil war and turning that civil war into a regional war. That would be an absolute disaster for the region and for the United States.
What do you think the United States should do in terms of, ending the occupation of Iraq in a way that won't further deteriorate the situation in that nation, the very violent conflicts that are ongoing there and the ethnic cleansing, as well as calming tensions in the region? As you said, Saudi Arabia is very fearful of a dominant Iran in the region, allied with Iraq.
I think the first step that the United States should take is to follow the recommendation of the Baker-Hamilton report and create an Iraq contact group consisting of Iraq's immediate neighbors, the Security Council members, and the GCC states and a couple of other Arab countries. We have to give states in the region a stake in the process of stabilizing Iraq. All of them have a stake in the outcome by virtue of being in that region. We have, however, not given them a stake in the process. We need to give them a stake in the process, and by that ensure that they're also taking their responsibility in ensuring that Iraq doesn't deteriorate. At this stage, since we refuse to talk to many of these countries, we are naive to believe that they're going to help us when we even won't dignify them by having discussions with them.
That was Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council. Contact the council at area code 202-719-8071 or visit their website at www.niacouncil.org. In late December, as the Democratic Party was preparing to take the reins of both the House and Senate on January 4th, advocates representing 102 business, consumer, environmental, and energy policy groups sent a letter to congressional leaders. The groups urged federal energy research and development funds be shifted from fossil fuel and nuclear power programs to those supporting renewable energy and energy efficiency. The letter specifically proposes changes in the fiscal year 2007 budget for the U.S. Department of Energy, which the 110th Congress is expected to consider shortly after convening in early January. The groups noted that, quote, a shift in federal funding from mature and/or polluting technologies to cleaner, safer, and sustainable energy sources offers the best option for curbing greenhouse gas emissions, reducing oil imports, and addressing the nation's other pressing energy and deficit reduction needs within the constraints of a very tight federal budget. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ken Bossong of the Sustainable Energy Network, which sent out the letter. He talks about the role that mandating efficiency regulations can play in reducing energy demand that is effective, both in terms of environmental impact and cost, and how renewables, such as wind, solar, and geothermal, can reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause global climate change. Bossong also points out that the Democratic Party-controlled Congress still presents obstacles to achieving the network's goals.
There were at least three major accounts that the Bush administration had targeted in either 2005 or 2006 for significant cuts. in some cases for total elimination. Two programs that were going to be eliminated altogether if the Bush administration had its way would have been the geothermal energy program and the advanced hydropower program. Then in addition, programs such as the distributed energy program, which among other things funds combined heat and power technologies, were slated for significant cuts. And then a number of smaller energy efficiency programs are also slated to have their total funding reduced. In fact, those programs have been slowly sliced in small amounts over the past 6 years of the Bush administration. So part of our program goal was to simply restore funding, if not increase it, for the basic core renewable energy and energy efficiency programs that are in the budget. So those are the areas that we wanted to have funds shifted into, though. And the total shift would be maybe $100 million, perhaps a little bit less, depending on how you count the different accounts. To pay for that, we targeted about 8 or 10 programs that are in the Nuclear Power Research and Development Program or the Fossil Fuel Research and Development Program, and suggested either eliminating or cutting back those programs, and those programs in total are about $400 million. So what we're actually advocating is reducing funding significantly in some sectors, applying some of the savings to renewables and efficiency, and the balance to budget deficit reduction.
Others who are coming to see that we shouldn't be so dependent on foreign sources of oil are still calling for more domestic drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, on the Rocky Mountain front, and offshore. The network doesn't support any of those options?
The short answer is, for the most part, we see those suggestions as being faulty for two reasons. One, they involve very expensive drilling because the areas that are being considered are in areas that are either inaccessible or just very expensive to drill in. So economically, it doesn't make good sense. And then environmentally, it doesn't make good sense either. And then the third consideration, the amount of oil or gas that would come from drilling either in some of the deeper offshore sites or in Alaska or in the Rocky Mountains or in some of the protected areas in the West would yield actually in total very little oil and gas. It amounts to maybe months or even in some cases weeks of supply at our current usage rates. You can get much further if we invested instead in energy efficiency, particularly improving energy efficiency standards for automobiles.
Could the government, for example, mandate that individuals and businesses must replace the extremely inefficient incandescent light bulbs with compact fluorescent lamps, known as CFLs? And would your network support that kind of legal mandate?
It's certainly possible for the government, either the national government or state governments, through building codes, to stipulate that lighting has to use certain technologies, and that's probably a more appropriate way to do it. That would be one option. Another option would be to include in both government and private definitions of what are considered to be energy efficient or zero energy homes, that they have to use certain technologies, whether it be compact fluorescents or certain efficient appliances or certain levels of insulation in walls or certain types of windows, all those kinds of things. And that actually is happening sort of spontaneously now. In the past 2 years, there's been an explosion in the use of what are called green building technologies, simply because the cost of energy has gone up so much.
Ken Bossong, with the new Democrat-controlled Congress, it looks like you'll still run into problems with people like Michigan Representative John Dingell, who's the new chairman of the House Energy Committee. He's made it clear that he's not interested in raising fuel efficiency standards, also known as CAFE standards.
My best guess is that CAFE, unfortunately, will not be taken up, at least not in any serious way, by the new Congress, even with a Democratic majority, in part for the reason you noted that Representative Dingell, who will be heading the Energy Committee in the House, has consistently opposed more rigorous CAFE standards. That said, however, in addition to the concern posed by rising oil imports, both in terms of national security and in terms of balance of trade payments, there's almost certainly going to be much more attention paid to the issue of climate change by the new Congress. And whether or not Representative Dingell likes it or not, there's no way to seriously address climate change unless you address oil use by automobiles and other forms of transport. So whether it be in this Congress or the 111th Congress, 2 years, my guess is the Congress will have to at some point address CAFE standards and call for more energy-efficient automobiles. There's just no way to avoid it.
That was Ken Bossong of the Sustainable Energy Network. For more information, call the network at area code 301-588-4741 or email them at sustainable-energy-network@hotmail.com. Over the last several years, discontent with the U.S. media system has been building. Sweeping plans for deregulation of broadcast outlet ownership, put forward by former Federal Communications Commission Chair Michael Powell in 2002, ignited a nationwide campaign to oppose the rules change and succeeded in temporarily blocking the measure. The grassroots movement that rose up to oppose deregulation is also critical of the programming choices available to citizens, leading them to strongly advocate for an increase in diversity of viewpoints on the airwaves. The group Free Press has been one of the key organizations coordinating this grassroots media mobilization. They are now making plans to hold their third annual National Conference for Media Reform, which will be held this January 12th through the 14th in Memphis, Tennessee. The conference will feature dozens of panels and workshops on a wide range of issues, including federal broadcast regulatory reform, media literacy, independent media, civil rights, and social justice. Among the speakers who will be addressing the conference are FCC Commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, Ben Bagdikian, author of the seminal book The Media Monopoly, documentary filmmaker Robert Greenwald, Free Press co-founder Bill Moyers, Reverend Jesse Jackson, and actor and activist Jane Fonda. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Craig Aaron, communications director with Free Press, who talks about the important media issues that will be discussed at this year's conference.
The National Conference for Media Reform, this will be the third event. We've had previous events, first one in Madison, Wisconsin, the last one in St. Louis in May of 2005. And, you know, we're hopeful this is going to be sort of our biggest and best so far. We're expecting around 2,500 to 3,000 people to come to Memphis on MLK Junior weekend, the weekend before the holiday, to talk about the media. It will be people from across the country interested in media issues, interested in learning more, some of whom are experts, journalists, policymakers, a lot of whom are just concerned citizens who have gotten interested in the media and the decisions that go on to shape it. So there will be FCC commissioners there. Jesse Jackson will be there, Bill Moyers, lots of academics and radio hosts and activists from across the country who are going to be sharing what they've done in their local communities to hold the media accountable, sharing some of their great media projects, independent media voices, folks from independent magazines and new television networks and folks all across the country. You know, the exciting thing about being involved in what is becoming a movement, the media reform movement, is that there have been some real victories. You know, we were able to hold off the phone companies this year as they tried to push through a really terrible bill in Congress that would have, you know, done away with net neutrality and really set us back a long way in bringing the Internet, bringing broadband to everyone. We're able to look at toward this new Congress actually with the opportunity to, instead of continuing to fight these defensive battles, potentially begin to set some of the agenda. It doesn't mean we'll win all the battles, doesn't mean we'll pass all the legislation that we'd like to see passed, but there is an opportunity to really put forward a much more aggressive and promising vision of extending these great technologies to everybody, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about a lot at this conference. Another one will be broadening this movement, how to talk about these media issues to an even broader swath of our country, of our communities, how we can expand the diversity of people who've gotten interested in these issues, how we can start to bridge the digital divide.
As you go into this conference, and as you said a moment ago, there's dangers and opportunities in the year ahead with a new Congress coming in. What are some of the below-radar issues that you would want people to pay attention to in this coming year?
Well, I think the big issues are going to be largely the same, but it'll be a little bit of a different spin. I mean, one thing that people, I would hope, are really paying attention to still is this issue of media ownership. The 2003 fight was a big win for the public interest, but there is still a majority of commissioners at the FCC that indications are interested in loosening these rules and getting rid of the longstanding protections that have ensured a variety of voices, that have kept one company from dominating an individual media market. And, you know, these comments are coming up. They're due in January. This is a fight that will probably, however, stretch out through the spring. So I really encourage people. We set up a website, another coalition called StopBigMedia.com, with lots of information on what's at stake with the rule changes. You can also read, there's beginner's information. You can read the 800 pages of comments we filed with the FCC if you're looking for something a little more in-depth, and I think a lot of everything in between. The other big issue is going to be what is going to happen with telecom policy, with broadband policy. The phone companies failed to pass their bad bill at the national level this past year. There's a lot of indications that they're going to try to get away with some of the same things by going state by state. So that's definitely something I would urge people to be on guard for, trying to pass the same kind of bill that would have gutted net neutrality, that wouldn't have protected the free and open Internet, but to get the things they wanted in that bill at the state level while trying to avoid the rules that we've always had to keep the Internet free and open.
We witnessed in the lead up to the Iraq war a virtual cheerleading by most of the corporate media, which basically put this country into a horrendous and bloody quagmire in the Iraq war. The media decidedly was not a watchdog. And that in part comes from the ownership issue. And I'm wondering, when you look at this conference coming up in Memphis, what kinds of things are being talked about in terms of the dire need to create alternatives or hold the corporate media accountable for their lack of scrutiny or holding the politicians' feet to the fire that they should be doing?
You know, one of the unfortunate realities is that we have reached a teachable moment, if you will, where the failures of the press to ask some of those tough questions are very, evident before us every day in so many of the terrible headlines coming out of Iraq. And that's one thing I think we'll definitely be focusing on at the conference. I know there's going to be one of our major panels. We're going to have Helen Thomas, the veteran White House correspondent, along with Paul Rykoff from Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and Eric Bollert, the media critic, and others talking about the failure of the mainstream media to really hold accountable this administration in the run-up to war. But we've seen, how important those independent voices are. And I think a lot more people seeking out those independent voices because of the failure of the mainstream to do that job, to hold people accountable.
That was Craig Aaron, Communications Director with Free Press. Contact Free Press to learn more about the National Conference on Media Reform by calling toll-free 1-877-888-1533 or visit their website at www.freepress.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.